Thank you, Dr. Gerbes. I'm very happy to be here today and have the opportunity to discuss with you our plans for post-Apollo lunar exploration. I imagine that many of you have been following the debate that has been raging both within NASA and outside of NASA as to what will be the next goal for the space program. The answer to this question was given in some detail at the end of January when the AAP, or the Apollo Applications Program, was first officially announced to the public. Those of you who saw the announcements, and possibly some who didn't, will remember that generally three areas were stressed for post-Apollo. The first area was a rather extensive program in Earth orbit. Essentially, this was a manned program using Apollo hardware, follow-ons to the Apollo hardware, to keep man in orbit for lengthy periods of time, both for studying biomedical reactions and to do quite a bit of science. The second area that was indicated was continuing lunar exploration. This was announced as a goal by President Johnson not too long ago when he indicated that we weren't only going to land on the moon for Apollo, but we would actually explore the moon. And the third rather major area was the Voyager program, initially directed to Mars and Venus. So this afternoon, I would like to discuss how we see the lunar exploration program evolving from Apollo. If I could have the first slide, please. For many reasons, the exploration program will hopefully be an evolutionary program. We could maybe start one step off the slide here with Earth-based observations and studies which have been conducted for many hundreds of years, the great majority of them obviously being conducted during the last few years. And the programs that have gone on to date, the Ranger, Orbiter, and Surveyor, laying the groundwork for our more detailed understanding of the moon, to be followed by the Apollo program, which has the objectives, in addition to giving us the capability of going to the moon and back, of doing some rather limited science. And I should say limited science in quotes. I'm sure that I have a rather prejudiced view, since I'm interested primarily in this area, as to what the science will be in Apollo. But even though limited, the Apollo science will be very excellent science, and of course probably some of the most exciting scientific discoveries in recent time will be made during the Apollo missions. But going on after Apollo, we have been constrained primarily by the Apollo hardware, and we've attempted to see how we can use the Apollo hardware in an evolutionary program, get the most out of the hardware, and do a good exploration program. And this is what the Apollo Applications program is all about. We will use the Apollo hardware. We will also continue to use unmanned systems throughout the program. And from the Saturn Apollo Applications, we would envision the program evolving into a temporary station long-range mobility phase. And finally, if the need or if the feasibility can be established, possibly permanent basis. Now, all of these areas beyond Apollo have been studied extensively during the last 3 years. And a number of paper studies have been conducted, both in-house and out-of-house at NASA. And for the Saturn Apollo Applications Program, some of the hardware is now coming into being, and I will show you some of that today. If I could have the next slide. The scientific objectives of of the Lunar Exploration Program have been stated as you see here. There's probably a further implied objective beyond the scientific objectives, and that is the technology that will be developed to support the scientific exploration, but I think there is a general feeling in NASA, and certainly by our consultants, that in order to really tie the program together, we must home in on these scientific objectives or the scientific worth of the program. Now, the first objective there will, even with the unmanned programs, will be looked at in Apollo and throughout the later phases of exploration that I showed you on the first slide. The second objective, to try and see what role the moon may have in future exploration or in future scientific investigations, is probably one that will come a little further downstream. We will attempt to do some experimentation on the Apollo applications, during the Apollo applications phase, and likewise for the last objective. We've received a considerable amount of help from the scientific community in attempting to define further what it is we're really going to try and study on the moon. About a year and a half ago at Woods Hole, the Space Science Board of the National Academy had a two-week meeting, at which time the whole space program was reviewed. There was a rather lengthy discussions as to what it was we should be looking for on the moon. And as a result of this meeting, if I could have the next slide, they came up with a series of major questions that we should be addressing ourselves during lunar exploration. Now, these questions are rather broad, I'm sure, as you can see. There are many parts, in some cases, to each individual question. They involve a number of different experiments. They involve timing as to when the missions might go to support. Some things obviously have to be done before others to come to some sort of conclusion on a subsequent question. Perhaps if I could just digress for a minute while you're reading these questions and explain a little bit as to what Apollo will be carrying out, what sort of science Apollo will be carrying out. I won't attempt to get into the instrumentation in any detail. This information can be made available if anybody has further interest. The primary objective of the Apollo missions, the manned mission, is to return lunar samples. And the total mission on the surface is being structured about this specific task. It appears possible now that some 50 to 60 pounds of samples can be returned on each Apollo mission. And these samples will be taken as selectively as possible during the mission. As presently conceived, the astronauts, when they first set foot on the moon, when they first leave the spacecraft, will take what you could call grab samples, the samples that we'll be taking for contingency purposes in case there may be an abort later on, and these will be just stored in a convenient location. Eventually, as the mission goes on, these samples will be discarded and more selective samples will be taken. The second activity, major activity that's being scheduled for Apollo, is the deployment of the ALSEP, or the Apollo Lunar Surface Experiment Package. Possibly some of you are very familiar with this package. As it is presently being designed, it will have about four experiments per array. There are two arrays being developed at this time, and there will be two Chinese copies of each array. The first two will fly, and then the array A, which will be structured around a passive seismometer and some radiation instrumentation. And the second array B, will be structured around the passive seismometer and a heat flow experiment, which is currently being developed by Mark Langseth at Yale. Now, in addition to the sampling and the deployment of the ALSIP, there will be some limited geological reconnaissance, and obviously the sampling and the geological reconnaissance go hand in hand. It appears now that that we may hope that the astronaut can traverse maybe up to a kilometer from the spacecraft. Rather limited, he's limited in his backpack capability and safety considerations. So this is essentially what Apollo will be doing for us. We hope to have these packages operating on the surface for a period of 1 year. They're being powered by an RTG system. And all of the data, of course, from these experiments will be extremely interesting, even though some of them are rather rudimentary. The next slide, please. Now, when we go beyond the Apollo, we, of course, struggle with the question of how the system should be. What is it that we should try and do beyond Apollo that the Apollo missions themselves cannot do? And the rather obvious conclusion was that we should attempt to cover as much of the moon as we can, as early as we can, and we should attempt to extend the stay time of the man on the surface and give him some sort of mobility. Now, even under an optimistic program, I think everyone will agree that there will not be a great percentage of the lunar surface actually traversed by man. I think that we'll have to depend on the use of sensors in orbit to gather gross data, which can be looked at small ground truth type of sites and extrapolated throughout the data. And this is the type of sensors that may be able to fly. This area has not been actively pursued. We have one rather large mapping camera system which is coming into being, which some of you possibly are familiar with. It's a joint project between the Air Force and NASA. But we have the capability to put on the missions, in addition to this mapping system, a number of other sensors. And this area is one that will, I'm sure, be pursued very actively in the near future. These missions could be flown, on the manned mission, could be flown as early as 1969. Now, in addition to the manned system, there is the possibility that follow-on orbiters of the type that are presently flying strictly photographic missions could be designed and flown with additional experiments beside the photographic experiments. On the next slide, you see a few of the things that we believe will be the high priority experiments to be done during the lunar surface traverse. Now, I did mention that the Apollo mission is only nominally about a one-day mission on the surface. The first Apollo will stay possibly 18 hours. During that time, we can hope that maybe we'll have about 12 man hours outside the spacecraft on the surface. And as I indicated, possibly a 1 kilometer radius of operation. Now, when you get into the types of observations and experiments that you see on this slide, it's obvious that we must be able to extend that capability considerably. On the next slide, there are some further, here is a typical payload then that we see possible for an AAP mission. Apollo payload right now is 250 pounds. When we go to AAP, we feel that we can start thinking in terms of several thousands of pounds. This is an error here. This should be 350. And the way we're going to do this is by using a dual launch mode. We will reconfigure the LEM to a shelter and to a taxi. The LEM taxi will be a transportation system similar to the present LEM, which will deliver the men to the surface and remain dormant during the time that they're exploring the moon, and then bring them back up into orbit to rendezvous with the command and service module. Now, the LEM shelter would be a modified LEM in which the astronauts would live during their exploration period, and which would also carry the experimental payload. On the next slide, you see some of the configurations that are being considered. The LEM taxi doesn't look much different than the present LEM. The major modification is that it would be dormant and be in storage for the 2 weeks, possibly up to 2 weeks on the surface, and then reusable after that length of time. Now, on the LEM shelter, there are some major changes. A lot of the tankage that you see on the LEM taxi is not required, or on the normal LEM, because this is ascent propulsion. This will remain on the surface after the taxi goes back, so all of that can be removed. In addition, we would hope to have a small airlock on the LEM to cut down on the use of oxygen every time that you had to repressurize the LEM as the men get in and out. The storage capability in the descent stage and around the ascent stage would be increased. And one of the major items that would be added to the LEM shelter in way of payload would be a mobility device. Now, several of the items that we've been looking at in some detail are, first, a lunar drill, which is on the next slide. The Apollo will carry a 1 to 3 meter drill, which has been designed primarily for the heat flow experiment to make a hole for the probe. And we have started to look at a much bigger drill capability. And presently, two contracts are underway. This is one of the concepts. The total drill weight that's being aimed at is 200 feet, and the depth of penetration for the drill is hopefully in excess of 100 feet. It looks like both of those numbers can be met. Some of the unique features about this drill is that it has a continuous drill string. This is wound on a drum, which eliminates the need to make connections as you go in and out of the hole. It would have a core barrel in the lower part, a cuttings catcher in the upper part, and would be essentially automated. It appears that we can automate this to a large degree. The drill would go into the hole, sense its penetration rate, sense the pressure on the bottom of the hole. When the core barrel was filled, it would automatically retract. The only operation, theoretically, that the man would have to become involved in was the actual extraction of the core from the core barrel. With this sort of a system, it appears that we could hope to drill holes in excess of 100 feet in about 24 to 30 hours of operation. The second type of drill that we're looking at is the wireline core drill, where the drill is made up of individual joints. However, the core is extracted on a wire line as you continue drilling. There's no need to keep going in and out of the hole as you drill. You just keep extracting the core until you get down to your total depth, at which time either you can do some preliminary logging of the hole if you so desire, or extract the drill. Both of these studies are underway now at the Marshall Space Flight Center. We're receiving support from the Bureau of Mines and the Corps of Engineers. On the next slide is a surveying staff concept that we're presently getting underway at the Manned Spacecraft Center. The purpose of such a system is to free the astronaut insofar as you can from monkey-like tasks of taking azimuths and bearing directions, or azimuth and dip and strike directions and things of this sort. It would also have a stereo camera and a TV camera incorporated in the system. It would be tracked automatically so that his position from a starting point would be known to a predetermined degree of accuracy, so his position in X, Y, and Z would be well established, and in addition, there would be sensors in the staff to measure the tip and tilt and pointing direction of the staff. And the present Apollo missions, there will be a small staff that goes along, but will have no automated functions. All of the readings will have to be made by the astronaut, which at the present time is making the staff possibly unattractive because of the amount of time that they'll have to utilize in reading out the staff. So we hope to get around this completely by making a staff completely automated. This will then give you your position of sampling, will give you positions of where you've laid out your instrumentation and things of this sort to a rather high degree of accuracy. A final piece of hardware that we're working on at the present time on the next slide is the LSSM, the Local Scientific Survey Module. We have two contracts underway on this. This is the Bendix four-wheel version. We also have one which is a Boeing General Motors six-wheel version. The capabilities of this vehicle would be to carry one man or two men. If it carries one man, we could put 700 pounds of equipment on it. Could traverse 25, it's a battery-operated vehicle, would be able to traverse about 25 kilometers on a single charge. The speed of the vehicle would be 6 to 10, top speed would be 6 to 10 kilometers per hour, down to some essentially zero speed, so that you could accommodate whatever terrain you were going over. It would have some support communications capability. In other words, it would act as the relay between the man on the surface and the LEM, or back to Earth. It would also be able to support scientific experiments. Now, this vehicle is rather far along in design, and I'd like to show you just two very short film clips of the last two items, so you might get an idea of how these things would operate. If I could have the first movie. Here is a very early version of the staff. What we've done here is just put a small camera on it, and here we're attempting to determine the feasibility of the system. It has the camera, it has a tip meter on it, and it has a small TV camera. There is strong feeling by a number of our advisors that it would be highly advantageous to have the astronaut on the surface monitored by a team of scientists in Earth at the Mission Control Center, and possibly advise him as to the conduct of his traverses. He would be able to transmit back close-up photographs of anything that he sees, and in this way we feel he'll be able to get the most out of the traverses. This whole area of how the astronaut will talk back to Earth is another rather important one that we're just starting to look at now. Since the major end product, let's say, of the mission will be a map. This will be one of the major things that the man ends up making, not necessarily on the moon. But we feel that it's very important that we have the capability during the mission to plot the map in real time. And on these longer missions of a week to 2 weeks, be able to talk to the man after a day's work, tell him how the map is looking, where the critical problem areas may be, how his sampling is tying into a previous geological interpretation that will be made of the landing site, and so forth. And that is the reason, of course, for trying to get this automated surveying system, so that the readout of the data can come back to Earth and can be plotted essentially in real time. Now the next little clip is a, if I could have the next clip, is a quick shot of how this vehicle looks. This is a second generation spacesuit that you see the man wearing there. This is a hard suit made by Litton. It's not the soft suit that Apollo will be using. This again is the Bendix version. It has a 1 meter step climbing capability. Most of the suspension, and this is a very difficult problem obviously in the 1.6G environment, is taken up in the wheels on this design. The wheels are flex wheels. We've had two of these out in volcanic terrains at Yuma under test during the month of January. So we're fairly far along with both of those concepts. Now, what sort of a mission could you hope to have during AAP using a roving vehicle of this sort and automating as much as you can the operations of the man and leaving him essentially free to be a scientific observer? We've taken some of the pictures. We're currently working on orbiter pictures, but at the time I developed this material, we only had the Ranger, good Ranger pictures to look at. So I'd like to show you now a map made in the crater Alphonsus from the Ranger 9 photography. If you remember the final shots of Ranger 9, it came in more or less in the upper northeastern quadrant of the crater Alphonsus. There were a number of halo craters in this area, some rills, and this is a topographic map made from that photograph. Now, on a typical two-week mission, we feel that we can plan one EVA or one traverse a day on the vehicle, and we would hope then that we could make 12 to 14 of these in total during the total mission. One of the primary recommendations that we receive so far is to set up on one of these missions a geophysical network. You would have a central station at the landing site and then three stations at the limits of your traverse capability. At the present time, we feel that we can traverse out to about 8 kilometers from the landing site. Our major constraint at this time appears to be communications. And this is about the limit that we feel we can go and have still maintain line of sight communications. This, of course, with rather high antennas on the LEM and tall antennas on the vehicle. It would appear that on these missions you could hope to get about 120 man hours on the surface. This is useful working hours. In addition to that, there would be some hours available and required to check out the LEM shelter and check out equipment, things of that sort. But about 120 hours for a 14-day mission. Now, in addition, it appears that there will be about an equal number of hours available to do science in the LEM shelter. When you subtract out the eating, sleeping, housekeeping chores, there's a rather large block. Now, these numbers are very preliminary, and I wouldn't want to be quoted too extensively as on these numbers, but it appears like they're fairly reasonable numbers. Now, the 120 hours in the LEM shelter is an area now that we're looking at. We have the geological survey at Flagstaff designing analytical equipment that could be carried in the LEM. One of the items that they feel has a high priority is a thin sectioning device with some sort of capability to possibly to examine the thin sections with a petrographic microscope possibly. This would very greatly increase your bring back capability in terms of rock sample. Other items that Flagstaff has looked at is the possibility that you might even take the petrographic microscope and put a TV camera in the microscope and transmit this back to Earth. And they've made some rather extensive studies of this, and it appears that this does in fact enable you to learn quite a bit about the rocks just by looking at a TV image in a petrographic microscope. The major time that he would spend on the traverses would be devoted to geological reconnaissance or geophysical traverses, conducting such things as gravity surveys, possibly some rather wide array refraction shots to determine subcrustal structure. And the sampling, of course, would continue to be one of the high priority tasks that he would do. We hope that on these missions we can up the bring back capability to about 250 pounds over the present Apollo, 50 to 80 pounds. Now, I see these missions primarily as a geologist would maybe see a type section study. You're still fairly limited in your mobility. You're going to have to pick these sites very carefully to take advantage of your time and the amount of distance that you can travel from your landing site. You have sufficient time here to do some rather detailed studies of the stratigraphy and of the structure. And you would use these missions to build your understanding of the moon so that on the later phase mission, which I'll get into in just a minute, you could actually conduct some rather long distance traverses and try and tie things together based on this rather detailed information. Now, the next two phases of the evolutionary scheme that I showed in the first slide are obviously nowhere near as well defined as the present AAP missions. The mission of the type that you see here could conceivably be flown in 1971. This is the target date that we're all shooting for in AAP, to have this capability by 1971. Now, based again on the recommendations of a number of NASA consultants, which met up in Falmouth about the same time as the Space Science Board, we've looked at the problem of long-range traverses on the moon. And this is the mobility phase, which you see in the next slide. This phase would possibly interconnect with some of the AAP mission sites. It would also, in our thinking, connect up areas which have been landing sites for surveyor-type vehicles. Remember, again, that the total program that I'm talking about, although I'm obviously emphasizing the manned phase, does include these unmanned probes. And the recommendations that we received so far have been that we have a traverse capability of several hundred kilometers, maybe up to 1,000 kilometers per mission, and have a three-man crew to run this type of a mission. Now, the major piece of hardware that we've looked at for this mission is shown on the next slide, called a MOBEX, for no good reason. It's a very large vehicle. It would carry an LSSM type of vehicle, which you saw previously in the movie. And this would give you the capability to stay at one site if you so desired, and not restrict yourself to that site, but also be able to move around on the smaller LSSM. This is about a 30,000 pound vehicle, Earth weight, and would have a 90-day traverse capability. It's at this stage in the exploration program that we that we have to start looking at uprating of the Saturn. For the Apollo applications program, the LEM shelter, LEM taxi, we can use the standard Saturn launch vehicle, but at this point in time, we would have to uprate the Saturn and get into the class of about 103,000, 104,000 pound payload to the moon. The final phase of exploration then might be a base. And on the next slide, I've listed a few of the things that appear to lend themselves to a base type operation. Possibly the area of astronomy may be the major justification at this time for a lunar base. Experiments will be developed for AAP and for later phases to attempt to determine if the moon does in fact have some unique feature which makes it very attractive to astronomy, both optical and radio astronomy. Well, what would such a schedule look like? What would such an exploration program look like, rather, if you put it into terms of a schedule, a launch schedule? On the final slide, we have a typical or an example schedule of launches. Each one of the X's below Apollo represents a Saturn V. And also here at the mapping and survey system, these are Saturn V launches. The missions indicated above, Surveyor and Orbiter, those launch vehicles are still to be determined. Apollo is nominally a three-mission program. It may carry on beyond that depending on how rapidly it's successful and how rapidly we can make the changes to the hardware later on in AAP. For the 70 missions, it would appear now that we'll have a uprated Apollo capability of several days, maybe up to 4-day missions. After 70, as I indicated, we're hoping to have a dual launch mission, one with the shelter logistics payload, which we will have go to the moon surface unmanned, followed by the LEM taxi. And finally, in the mobile exploration phase, we'll also have a dual launch type of mission where the MOBEX, which you saw, would go first down to the moon, followed by the men. Now, in the temporary station, which might be the lunar base phase, it would appear that we can, by about 1977, hope to have 6 men staying on the surface of the moon for 6 months or so. This would still be essentially Apollo hardware, but it would be modified. There would be a large shelter module which would go with the mission, and possibly some payload modules. And this has been studied quite extensively now as to how this evolution might be. If I could have the lights again. Well, that in brief is the way we're pointing ourselves right now. Possibly some of you have seen the PSAC report, the President's Scientific Advisory Committee report, which came out with the budget. They are essentially supporting the AAP program as I've outlined it here. The present 68 budget looks fairly good at this time. Whether it'll still be that way a couple of months from now, I don't know. But there's about $450 million in the 68 budget to get on with the AAP program. I think of particular interest possibly to you all here in this audience is that there are a number of opportunities now developing to put rather large experiments, not necessarily large, but we have a large, we have a large experiment payload capability, and a great amount of this capability is rather in a hazy position at this time. The agency really has not gone out as yet and actively solicited experiments for this program. And I would certainly recommend to any of you here who are thinking in this area, and I know that there are some people in the audience who have experiment ideas, to start hammering on the door, because this is kind of a two-way street. The program is dependent upon having a backlog of good experiments to make it a really worthwhile program. So we need the experiments to help the program progress. Now, I'd be very happy to answer any questions that may be raised on the floor. Yes, sir.
Presumably, is this a two-part program where the equipment will go separately to the bodies, or everything will go together?
After Apollo, it is a two-launch, essentially the AAP phase and the long-range mobility phase is two launches. The first launch goes up like a normal Apollo with a crew. Once they're in lunar orbit, I assume this is what you're asking. Once they're in lunar orbit, they detach the logistics payload and it lands unmanned. Present Apollo essentially has this capability to land unmanned. So for both of these next for all of the phases, this will be the way it goes. Now, when you get to the lunar base time frame, it's hoped that we'll have a direct flight capability. We won't have to go LOR anymore. But for AAP and the mobility phase, we'll maintain the LOR mode, take the logistics up with the men, detach it, land it unmanned, they'll come home, and then within some time period, possibly 3 months or so, the men will go up to utilize the equipment. Well, for the base phase, this has been the thinking, that you'd possibly land several payloads up there before the men got up there. Now, there's nothing to stop you downstream from launching on rather narrow time intervals. There is the capability to launch rather quickly, even though Apollo is going to go on 3 month centers. The capability will be there to launch rather quickly if you want to.
Yes?
You mentioned communications. I wonder if you'd say a bit more about this. I was a little puzzled by the statement, which I understood you to make, that on this relatively small exploration, there was something like an 8-kilometer range.
We're assuming here that you have only line of sight communications. Yes.
Is it telemetry type or is it voice type?
It's both. Both voice and telemetry. The present Apollo, I believe, runs on a VHF system. The present backpack telem communications is a VHF system. So because of the rather short horizon on the moon, your line of sight is very restricted. Yes. Yes.
A question that may not be so minor. I'm a little bit puzzled by the choice of the unit of measure. There's a mixture of the British and the decimal. Is there any plan, actually, for decimal or things come as they are? The blueprints of the hardware, for instance, are they made in the decimal or the British? The actual calculation?
I think that they're made in both. I'm quite sure that Marshall, for instance, which is the booster developer, requires that their contractors report in both systems. But I think that there was an initial push to try and get it all into decimal, and they ran into such tremendous problems with the contractors that they had to do both. But I think they're doing both. Now, on the spacecraft, I'm not sure.
It
will be intact.
Okay.
one 30,000 pound payload, which is what you could put up there on a single launch. Well, the Mole Lab was our first cut at trying to see what mobility would look like on the moon. And it was designed specifically for a LEM truck payload. And the LEM truck isn't what it sounds like. It's a LEM descent stage, which has been fully automated, and nothing on top. You could put anything on it you want it to. You're only constrained by the SLA, the spacecraft LEM adapter, which goes on the outside to make your aerodynamic shape. And it had at the time we started, a 14,000 pound upper limit as to what you could put on the LEM truck. And so the Mole Lab grew within those constraints. And this we started about 3 years ago. It was a two-man vehicle, and we considered that it would have possibly a 50-mile operating radius. Well, subsequent to those studies, we have looked at things like MOLEM, just to make sure we weren't missing a bet somewhere along the way. But subsequent to those studies, it appears that if you interject an AAP phase, which is a rather simple vehicle, doesn't have any environmental control on it, the man must utilize his own spacesuit and so forth, that the next jump then is not to a Mole Lab, but to a bigger vehicle. And this is what we've attempted to look at. Now, please understand that to date, these have only been paper studies primarily. And there's no final configuration or even any real hard thinking on this mobility phase. We're hoping, we've designed that launch schedule that I showed you there and the missions so that we would be able to get some feedback from the mission to influence your next phase. The AAP phase, in other words, was about 4 years, which is right about what your lead time is on some of the new hardware. So we would hope that we're getting some return from these missions to help us decide final designs, and likewise for the LEM base.
Yeah. I'd like to know what type of power source you plan to use by the time you get this temporary station up. Will it be battery to save the time?
Well, there have been a number of studies on this, and about all I can say is that everything has been looked at, and everything is still a possibility. There have been looks at nuclear power. OART, for instance, has been looking at football field-sized solar cell things that you could roll out on the surface. I don't know how far along they've gotten with that sort of an idea. We've looked rather extensively at fuel cells. For the first AAP missions, we're going to be primarily dependent upon batteries. The LEM and the vehicle that you saw, for instance, will be primarily battery operated. Now, the second generation scientific package, like the Apollo ALSIP, which is currently using an RTG system, I would suspect we'll attempt to continue with that, because we're looking here for a year to 2 year lifetime for the power system. And not only that, but continuous operation for some of these experiments. You want the capability to look at them anytime you want to.
You talked about remote sensing and the low field mapping, which Andy Sixman put on the maximum. I propose moving the entire photo mapping area system and scale-wise.
Well, I'm not quite sure I got your question. We will have, for instance, on the Apollo mission, complete geological maps will be made, a geological interpretation will be made of all of the Apollo landing sites, a preliminary interpretation. After the man gets up there and wanders around and samples and so forth, you'll be able to check your interpretation against what he actually saw, and you undoubtedly will modify it. And based on that, you can probably extrapolate your interpretation then to larger and larger areas, wherever you have good photo coverage. Now, we expect that the mapping and survey camera system is going to allow us to have photographic coverage at rather good resolution of the total moon. We'll even have that during orbiter. The next orbiter mission, which goes in May, is going to photograph the total front side, 85% of the front side, at about 60 to 80 meters resolution. That's nominally what the objective of Orbiter D is. Now, with other sensors which are still to be defined, but for instance, IR sensors such as are being worked at here at AFCRL, you can hope to maybe do some compositional differentiation of units. You would land then in a number of places, check out the actual composition of the materials at that area, check them against your remote sensor data, see whether you have in fact interpreted it correctly, and then extrapolate that data to larger and larger areas. And there are a number of other sensors that have been suggested, and I'd hesitate to indicate now which may be developed and which may not, but there are a number that have been suggested.
How do you propose to land at all these other points to obtain ground control?
Well, at this time it would be hard to say how many points you'd have to land at to have sufficient ground control. Maybe you never will have enough, is what it amounts to, I guess. But certainly, I'm sure you've probably seen the geological survey maps of the moon, the geological interpretations of the moon. Now, I personally feel that, in essence, these maps are probably right. Whether they've got the genesis of the features down correctly may be debated. But the fact that one formation overlies another formation, therefore this unit is younger than that unit, and so forth, and that this is a discrete unit, for instance. This is a mappable unit. Now, we don't know what that mappable unit really means yet, but by landing at several sites, you can probably very quickly look at quite a few of these units if you pick your sites carefully. I mean, they're already doing this. They're already mapping the moon and making an interpretation, and as I say, I feel that probably these are intrinsically correct, the interpretations.
What you showed indicates completely manned and completely unmanned kinds of explorations. Is there any attempt to run a combined system, such as a mobile vehicle which would be unmanned but under the control of a person on the moon?
This has certainly been considered. As you may know, for Surveyor, they developed a rather small roving vehicle. And I don't know of any program which is actively looking now at how this may be applied to lunar exploration, but it has been suggested, and I
might save a lot of the
one of the other right now. One of the things that we have looked at, though, is automating the LSSM and the MOBEX. In other words, it would be able to operate by itself before you got there, and we've received rather strong recommendations that this be built into the vehicle. Unfortunately, at the present time, we're limited in being able to look at this in any detail because it rapidly increases the cost of such a vehicle if you want it to operate independently and remotely.
Last question? Yes?
If you don't mind expanding the scope of the talk a little bit, would you comment briefly on manned exploration of the planets?
Well, I meant to mention when I had the 15 major questions, and I guess it slipped my mind, that if you look at the 15 questions that have been posed by the Space Science Board, these are essentially the same kinds of questions you'll ask of any planet. Some of them are possibly unique to the moon, but not too many of them. Essentially, they're asking, what is this planet that we're looking at? Now, I feel quite strongly that ability to study the moon as a new planet now is going to be a very, very rewarding type of exploration, because the same types of things that we'll be attempting to do on the moon, we're going to attempt to do on any other planet. You will have some remote sensing data which will give you some indication of what the planet is. You'll never be able to explore the planet as fully as we can explore the Earth. So all of these techniques that we'll develop for the moon will be directly applicable, I feel, to any other planetary body. Now, there are strong feelings in NASA at this time that the agency should announce as its goal flying to Mars by 1975. And there are many obvious reasons for this, why people feel this way. I don't know whether that will ever get off the ground by 75. Probably it won't, but I certainly foresee that we can certainly hope to have manned missions to Mars by the end of the next decade. I think we're, without too much extension of our present capability, we can probably do this. Now, whether the kind of money that's needed to do this will be ever appropriated, I don't know. It's obviously a big program. Well, the present Apollo, you know, is going to have real-time television link. You're going to be able to, the first guys that get out of the LEM, you're going to be able to watch them on your home TV. So the present LEM has, of course, this capability. I don't know what the bandwidth is that's available. It's rather extensive. What we're attempting to do, though, is get incorporated into the mission control people's minds the fact that the Mission Control Center should be accomplishing something other than just operational tasks. That in fact, by properly designing the Mission Control Center and the communication link that we have with the moon, we can greatly augment what the man can do up there. Now, I don't know if that answers your question, but that's the way some of us would like to see it go. Everybody won't agree with that. Go over at the AIAA and see it? Did you see it at the AIAA meeting here in December? It was on display at that time, if any of you were over there. Yeah. Excuse me.
Back to the problem. Is that thing, what kind of a tire does that have?
It has a metal elastic tire. It's
Does it have any brake climbing ability to speak of?
The wheel that you saw there didn't have any kind of lugs or anything on it. It was just a sort of a mock-up vehicle. That vehicle that you saw there was strictly a test mobility vehicle, just to see how the thing hung together. And it was it had another primary task of looking at human factors types of things. They were looking at ways to steer it, where you'd hang things, and what the carrying area should look like. So that vehicle, I don't mean to imply that that's the way it's going to look when it goes to the moon, but it's being designed for a 30 degree slope and a 1 meter step climbing capability.
Yeah. Still on the subject of that vehicle, how complicated would it be to put it together?
No, it will go up together. It will go up completely intact.
The small vehicle goes up.
Completely intact. It's designed to fit around the present LEM configuration just as is, and it will have an offloading mechanism. There will be nothing that the astronaut has to do with the vehicle other than charge it up after he's used it.